Welcome to the Travelling Senorita, episode 198. Well, Blues Fest has been and gone again, and what an epic festival it was. I did a roundup last week, which you can tune into. And this week I'm going to talk, I guess, to one of the nuts and bolts of the storytelling of Blues Fest. And Justin Brown from Brown Dog Productions, he is often seen backstage for hours and hours on end with his team, collating all the interviews and the visuals from across the festival. So I thought, you know what, let's interview him. G'day, Juzzy. How you doing in Brisbane?
Hi, Carlos. Good, thanks. I'm actually in Melbourne.
Even better. This is it.
Do you want to start the interview again? No.
No, not at
I'm
all.
I'm in Melbourne because I'm visiting my daughter for a couple of weeks after the festival.
I love that. Well, you know what? It's a travel podcast, so that actually speaks volumes. But before before we speak to your travelling heart, let's talk about Juzzy growing up in Brisbane town. You know it better than me. I've kind of been in and around there for a couple of years. But whenever I run into you, I always learn a little bit more about Brisbane. So what was it like growing up in Brisbane?
Well, I was born in 1964, so I'm turning until anyone 60 this year. That's crazy.
Unbelievable.
And don't tell anyone, seriously. And I went to kindy for 2 years.
Yep.
Before school, from 3 to 5, and then I went to Ascot State School, 7 years. And that was a really good school. Very safe, and we used to, you know, compared to these days, like an 11-year-old in Melbourne, and you know,
different.
Everyone's just paranoid about where the child is all the time, and you know, can't take your eyes off them.
Yeah,
you know, go into a shop. Anyway, won't go into that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just roam free. Everyone had swimming pools in their backyard and BMX bikes, so it was pretty amazing. And then, that sort of teenage years, I think it's like changed, don't you, from now?
Well, I'm born in 1969, so I'm not that far behind you, and I grew up in country, you know, Mornington Peninsula in Victoria. And we did have a lot more freedom to roam around, and Brizzy would have been, as they used to call it, like the big country town back then, right?
It was a bit of a crappy city, really.
Well, no,
Did
you get to hang out with like the likes of Powderfinger and those cats and see them out on the streets in Brisbane?
Oh, no, jamming on the side of the street. No, never saw Powderfinger. I've seen Powderfinger once, actually.
The
70s. I mean, I wasn't really into music that much. I mean, I played in the Ascot State School fucking big band.
Yeah.
Trumpet. And, you know, I thought it was pretty cool. And then I went to grammar. And because I wasn't good enough to do, like, jazz or classical, they put everyone into the parade band.
Yeah.
Like those, you know, those big Americana kind of style parade bands with, you know, stupid hats and epaulets. And we were, like, red and gold. It's very embarrassing, but you know, you got to play the old. I still know the old tunes, you know, Colonel. You know, they used to play actually a lot of TV tunes from the 70s and 80s.
So
Hogan's Heroes and all that sort of.
I got a very funny visual of you then. Now, as an academic, because I know you as you know, music producing videos and all that jazz. Excuse the pun, but as an academic, did I hear that you'd studied law at uni?
Well, I mean, I'm sort of like, you know, what's the point, really? I mean, I like to hear it. It's good to come up as a surprise and people go, bullshit, no way, you didn't do law. Did you finish? Like you said before, did you finish? That's the first question.
Oh, no, that's really rude of me to say that.
I finished.
No, that's so rude. That's really rude that I asked you that.
No, it's all right. Everyone does because they're quite, like, nah.
No, dude, I'll tell you why I said that, because I studied archaeology and anthropology and I didn't finish. So people always go, what? You studied archaeology? And I was like, I did 2.5 years and bailed. So that's why I asked you. Okay, so then did you go and work in the corporate sector? Were you in and around that law?
Yeah, a little bit of time. So I finished at UQ, then I went. Then back in the day, they used to have, like, big companies would come to the university, and there'd be like all the big chartered firms would come in, and they'd try and convince you to work for them. So you didn't have to send your, like, I don't know, these days I think it's a bit harder to get a job, especially commerce or law. And you sort of, these guys are almost desperate to get you. I'm going, dude, seriously, I don't really know what I've just studied. I can't remember anything. But they, because you had commerce law, I bumbled my way through that. Chartered accounting firm, Sydney Price Waterhouse, but yeah, we got you.
Wow.
Then they think you're going to be super smart and, you know, take on big legal cases and, you know, you're going to do your chartered. And I just stayed there for 2 years, biding my time. I can't believe they didn't sack me before I went, no, I'm going to Europe now. So I just got a one-way ticket to Europe, thought, oh, I've got this commerce law scam in my, you know, registered in my back pocket, and we'll see what happens. So
you'd laugh because my CV said deferred for travel purposes, and I actually thought, I thought that was super cool back then, and then I've realized like it's still on my LinkedIn. I'm like, oh mate, because I literally defer life still now.
That's kind of fun
for travel purposes.
You wouldn't change that.
No, not at all. So when you arrived in London, what are we talking, late 80s, early 90s?
I think it was, I think I was about 25, and, you know, in the prime of my life, as you say, and not that you knew it, I just felt like I was really young, and so I just, I think I landed, actually, kind of funny, is this, do you want your semi-funny traveling story?
So,
I get on the plane, I'm in the queue to go to the plane, I've never been overseas, get in the queue. And this girl I knew from uni, who was quite, you know, attractive.
Gorgeous,
yeah. She was a air hostess. And she said, oh, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Thailand for 2 weeks, Bangkok, staying in Bangkok. She said, oh, great, do you want to stay with us? I'm with my two other you know, hosties, two hosties. And I went, yeah, it'd be really good. I felt like I was 12. And they got on the phone, and then I get off the plane, and they're holding me up because I didn't have a green form or something. But the guys holding me up have got machine guns. They're fucking serious.
Yeah.
And they see the girls over there, we'll meet you at the hotel. And I'm going, oh, no, just fuck that up. Anyway, I get through, and they wait for me. We go to the hotel. It's back an hour and a half. It's this big, fancy hotel. And I'm going, oh, this is great. I said, look, I'm just going to go get something to eat downstairs and some street food. And I went, oh, okay, yeah, we'll see you later. And they weren't at all interested in me. Like I was no stooge. So they were going, you know, I can imagine when I left, they're just going, fuck, thank God, who invited him? Anyway, I was down the street, and I end up, this tuk-tuk driver was sort of eyeing me off, and he was like driving backwards as I was walking up the street, going, no, you've got to come with me, you've got to come. Anyway, so it can be a very long story, I cut it short. End up getting in the tuk-tuk, go all the way over town, and going, and his name was Mr. T. And I'm going, Mr. T, you can take me back to where we were. Hey, you take me back to the exact spot where we were. Yes. And he's going, oh, I take you back. And then we ended up going to, because I didn't know where we came from. I didn't have my passport. All I had was some cash and ready to pay Mr. T whatever he wanted. So he went to the thing, and then I said, okay, now we finish it. It's a terrible, empty, huge restaurant on the other side. Ended up coming back, and he got, one more stop for you. And I'm going, no, seriously. I'm like quite scared going, he could fucking do anything with me. And we went to a brothel, his friend's brothel.
Excellent. Yeah.
Which would have been quite fun, you know, if it was some people or, you know, it was like a bit loose. But I was like, straighty 180 off the plane. Yum. You know, hadn't drunk anything. Yeah. He'd drunk two tallies of beer at the restaurant. And then I ended up going into this like cement, like Besser brick wall brothel, and people parading in front of us going, no, Mr. T. I just, seriously, I don't. Anyway, I got out of there, got home, and without having to, you know, sell my dignity. And then I came upstairs and saw the girls, who are all drunk, and then they're going, oh, hi. Didn't even ask me what I'd done. I thought I'd had the biggest life story of my life.
Yeah.
So I came to tell someone.
Isn't that sort of indicative of, I kind of I have a similar story, but different. When I left around early 20s on my own to London. And you think at the time, because you've just, you know, grown up quite, I guess, you know, you've grown up in comfort and no risk really taking going on, and you get overseas and it just all melts away from you, doesn't it? Everything seems large and just so full on. But I imagine with you, there would be so
There's many mistakes to be had everywhere, as opposed to driving to university and back. And
in your own space. Yeah. But I imagine with you, stories like that would be, like, you'd have a few stories throughout your time in Europe, I imagine.
They're usually disaster stories, you know.
You made it, mate.
You're recovering from disaster.
You're nearly in the six vibes, so you made it. Now, fast forward the travelling heart, and well done to you, because you're educated, you're travelling. How long did you stay overseas for? The obligatory 2 years?
I did 2 years.
Yeah.
So I won't tell a story like that, but I just went, I basically went to London, spent a couple weeks in London, and then backpacked around France, came back to London, went over to Italy, got a job in Italy selling cleaning chemicals.
Yes, you do.
In language, which I didn't have. And then we went, with that company, went to Sweden and Finland. It was just a total scam, I found out. And we're just slaves to them, really.
Yeah.
Interact Chemical Company Italia. We're an American company.
Yeah, right.
And then my two big glamour jobs were, I went back to England and I got a job in the French Alps as a handyman. But snowboarding, you know, it was the best job at this company. And then I got a job teaching windsurfing in Turkey for 6 months.
Oh.
Or five, yeah, for
was
a summer.
That,
it was so good.
Near Aludenes or somewhere like that? Down south?
It was a place called Gevergenlik, which is near Bodrum.
Ah, yeah, okay. What a great...
Yeah.
Geez, that's a good wrap up there. And then, okay, so let's fast forward and... I mean, you started what you're doing when you were around 30. I'll give a little intro of what I think it is that you do that I've noticed about you. You're definitely like a fire starter. You build something from nothing, right? So you arrive in festivals like Blues Fest, Byron Bay and Woodford, and you build stuff and you bring a team of like pros with you and you document it. And I would say you are like true storytellers of music and festival. Give me your wrap of how you started in your 30s. Firstly, how you got into that after the experience that you had, and where it's progressed to now.
Well, okay. So, got back from Europe, did 5 years of the dog food company. A bit humiliating.
Wow.
They sold Pal, Chum, Meaty Bites, Kitty Cat, Dine, Schmackos. I like the Schmackos.
Of course you did.
Goodo.
Yeah.
5 years at them, and then just wasn't going anywhere. I ended up, I can't talk about that. I'll go into the real topic, which is, so I quit that, and I was trying to work out what to do. My brother-in-law ran, he was quite very successful, and he was selling microbreweries to Japan, like these half-mesh microbreweries. And so you put them into restaurants and into factories, just had a tap coming out of a factory and people put their bottles under it and you pay $10 or whatever, right through to a fancy one in a hotel. And he said, oh, do you want to... I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, do you want to do something for us? And I went, no. He said, I hadn't filmed before. And he said, do you want to make a corporate video on what we do? And I said, why not? Yep, I think I could do that. And bought a camera at duty free at the airport as we're flying out to Japan. And just had, I didn't realize, you know, you'd even have to charge the battery. So like half a battery, pulled it out of the packet in the plane and read the instructions, very confusing. So I guess I've got to wing this. I've got a tripod, cheap tripod, and this camera, which looked pretty good.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll film the shit out of it and try to look like I know what I'm doing and see how we go. And ended up bumbling my way through a corporate video. Tyrone Noonan actually did, did the song for it.
Wow.
Yeah, because I knew Tyrone. And Katie scat on it. Katie Noonan.
Yeah.
It's wow. Crazy. And it, anyway, it was pretty. I mean, I wouldn't look at it. It's on video, VHS. And then, yeah, that just sort of started me. I just started filming parties all the time. If you ever want to get good at, like, and feel comfortable with a camera, you just got to take them everywhere you go, parties. Everyone's filming on their phone, which is a bit different.
That's really interesting you say that, because I'm audio. That's the way I learn. And I take my microphone wherever I go, you know? Because you can just capture... I mean, a lot of what I do is spontaneous and I don't script it, because it's like a moment that happens, you know, and you just capture it. So I really relate to that. And I was also thinking, getting a visual then of your tripod, and back then it would have actually looked like you knew what you were doing.
It was like a really skinny tripod, you know. I think it was a Manfrotto, cheapest one you could get. In a cheap black plastic sort of case. And everyone films. Why would you bring a camera to a party to have fun, or a wedding, or a funeral, or whatever these days? Because, unless you're a corporate kind of person, you wouldn't bring a camera to a party, because your phones are just so perfect. But we used to do that, you know. It's like practicing an instrument. Like a harmonica, I play harmonicas. I used to always have that in my pocket.
Yeah, right. And because, the tripod in the other one.
Yeah, you'd be bored shitless on a train, or...
Yeah, right.
Or, you feel a lump in your pocket and you go, there we go, that's right, I can do that for a little while.
So did you start to get a reputation around town of, you know, the guy that was documenting good times?
Nah, not really.
No?
No, there's... No one had any real expectation from me, I'm pretty sure. Where am I heading? But then eventually you start thinking, I'm going to make documentaries and then end up on film sets and make a real good feature film or TV series, which I think I'm capable of, but it just doesn't. It's so hard
to get
all the ducks lined up.
Let's talk about what you are capable of, because you've been doing, I believe, Blues Fest for nearly two decades. Correct me if I'm wrong. And you've been like brown doggy dog out the back there, just interviewing some of the most iconic musicians and, you know, some unknowns as well, which are often the gold of the Blues Fest. How do you get a gig like that? And let's talk about some of the people you've interviewed that have just rocked your boat.
We pitched to Woodford to put a DVD together for them. So they wouldn't even let us in until the last day. Bill Horrocks made his decision, don't make us look shit. We've got to approve everything. And I went, so there's just me and a couple of people, and we did 21 acts, 21 different shows, little interlocutory pieces and stuff, and then put them all together. And it was, a lot of them were me filming one show. So I'd film from the front of house and go, that looks fucking amazing. Oh yeah, that's good. And then I'd run around and find a song that was a similar pace and get all the cutaways, crowd, wide of the tent, then drummer, all these sort of things you get away with. Anyway, we did this thing and they liked it. And because they'd always been sort of, presented by the media as, big hippie, pot-smoking, muddy festival, can't say it's totally untrue. There's nothing wrong with any of those three things. But, I think the fact that the further you get away to go swing the pendulum towards the big money people that you want in the festival.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing they're aiming for, to say they got a balance of money, but they don't want to be perceived. But the people who are going there, back in the day, were trying to sort of merge with the hippies a bit, and you can traditionally every year you come back from Woodford and go, I can't believe I finally look like I'm meant to be at Woodford, because you've shopped at all the little shops and got all your cool outfit. And then you just go, I'm never going to just realise you'll never wear that until another year, maybe.
So you got that.
So I made a DVD. I made three of them in a row.
Was that pro bono work? Was that just something you were volunteering to do?
No, I produced it. So, you know, got the clearances, edited it, put the DVD together, did the sound, you know, made the sound good, and then marketed it and tried to sell it. And I did that. It's freaking hard work.
Yeah.
Nothing else to do, so, and I thought this is quite a good opportunity. So did three of them, and we got some good press from the Australian, Weekend Australian.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they gave us 4-star reviews, and they, you know, I don't know if anyone read it, but I cut it out, and it looked, the guy painted a very nice picture of what we're doing. I don't think it didn't boost my sales at all, because I was like, after I sold 50, huh?
Let's go back to the time, though. Like, this is way before YouTube and all the Fandango equipment and phones that are nuts.
2003.
So you're kind of standing out there on your own doing this stuff, right? I mean, at the moment, now everybody's a photographer and everyone's a filmmaker, you know, because of a phone. But back then, you would have been quite, I guess, on your lonesome in a lot of ways for the festival work that you were doing, particularly in Queensland and then in northern New South Wales.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. You're not really thinking of that, who was out there with me. But one thing that was really hard back then was editing wasn't that easy.
Yeah.
There was no YouTube fucking instructional videos. Yeah, yeah. Maybe 7 different variations on.
I guess what I'm trying to do there, Juzzy, is give you a compliment, mate, because it's 2003. I mean, Facebook didn't launch until, I don't know, mate, it was like literally 2008, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But you've got to think of the time, you know, like you've just always done it and you've done it for so long that it's part of your DNA. But to really go back to that time, as you said, the editing tools, the equipment wasn't anywhere near what it is now. The progression in your industry is next level. But somewhere along the line, you've had the trust and to still be engaged by 2 incredibly iconic festivals. So that takes a fair bit of work, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, well, we kind of used the Woodford, the fact that we're doing stuff at Woodford to get into Blues Fest.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then that was really hard work for years, and still can be.
Let's call it challenging. Still its challenges. Yes.
Total 2 different festivals, totally different festivals, and they wanted totally different things that we were sort of suggesting they needed. Like, it's not, you go to a festival these days and they go, yep, well, we need social media. We want clips coming out all day. We want, if you can, we obviously want a big one to lead in, a good one to lead in, sell tickets. We definitely want the big finale video to show everyone how amazing it was as a reward and to get new punters in. But back then, it was like, there was no social media.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck, this guy can fucking put them out in DVDs and sell them in the festival shop. So that was kind of cool. That was like a way for them to sell, you know, to promote it,
I
guess.
Can I also say that, like, a way for them to have documented history? I mean, that festival's been going for 35 years. And, you know, for 17 of those years, you've been documenting those moments that we see.
I've done half of them now.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, and that archive footage is just invaluable, you know, it's incredible stuff. Some of those, I mean, I see your crew now. Like, I mean, you've got a team of, how many work with you at Blues Fest, for example?
I think there's 15.
Yeah, right. So if you go back to your first time at Woodford to where you are now, I see your crew all over the place. I try and get backstage, but I'm just so excited front of stage. And then I look at your crew, and I might be having, like, the time of my life, and I'll look to the left, and there's one of your dudes just capturing exactly what we're seeing and feeling.
Yeah.
And then you mash it all up, and it somehow appears within 24 hours on our feed.
Yeah, it's
to remind
really
us why we need to go back the next day because we're exhausted.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, no, the key is, I found this the last few years at Woodford, I mean, I haven't nailed it every year, but when you get a really good crew who just love it, because we set up such a big, beautiful, you know, as you know, that space back there, it's gorgeously set up by
our mates,
by the girls,
our mates,
yeah,
at Love Street,
your mates,
yeah, your mates, all of our
Carly
mates,
and Tara, yeah, yeah.
And Love Street, beautiful girls, and they do a
yeah
job.
And we got the old 59 Pilot, this beautiful old 1959 English caravan, this disheveled old thing,
yeah,
is the backdrop. And and then we got a really nice production area, you know, air-conditioned donga and couches in there. And it's everyone walks through yeah there goes, fucking hell.
Yeah.
What is happening here?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
even the green room.
Even, you know, Tom Jones said that.
Yeah. The green room's like, you know, it's fancy and perfect and sort of, but it's corporate because it's just carpeted walls and a white plastic table with some Aneski if you're lucky. You know, and that varying degrees of, depending on how far you're up the bill, of I better watch myself here. There's some amazing
comforts,
green room stuff too, and flower arrangements, and and then they've got all their food, you know, beautiful gourmet food and everything. But our area is really good, and because we make that cocoon go early and make it really fucking awesome, have beautiful speakers in there and beautiful lighting. We don't ask for any lighting, just ask for a couple of PowerPoints. The crew just feel special, and they just will do anything.
Yeah,
and they do. You know, they go hard.
I've been there when the musos come in, and they're always awe inspired before you sit down and interview them because of the visual splendor around them. You know, like it's just it's an incredible space. It's a mixture of kind of like, I don't know, like almost like a Woodstock vintage vibe, but super relaxed and contemporary at the same time. Like it's good. It's, and you know that there's a lot of hard work getting done there, which brings me to my next question. You do something at Woodford, like you've gone a little bit further than just producing a DVD. You do this thing called the Pineapple Lounge, which people talk about all the time. So this creative spark that you have inside you, because you are somebody that does, you surround yourself with good people, good creative people, but you're the one with that crazy idea at 2 a.m. in the morning, I reckon.
Well, I don't know. I think I'm just, that was just a good kind of lucky moment, I guess. Because, the Pineapple Lounge is a very good bar at Woodford. It's all made out of bamboo, handcraft, every year, totally different. But I think it's Woodford's, I mean, it's usually Woodford's highest grossing bar out of like 17 bars or something.
Right.
Maybe 15. It came about because I've been doing the filming and they've done these three DVDs and they were going, yeah, make more DVDs. You know, we want to, it's like, I was going, fuck, this is so hard. I don't want to do this every year. And I was going, the trifecta's pretty good. But I kept bringing people up thinking, okay, come on. But then it was those terrible rainy years. And then it rained 3 years in a row. And I was just like, I just tell the crew halfway through, who are getting paid two-fifths of their fall, let's just call it off. I can't stand this. This is just making, you know, it was just a shit show trying to make it look good.
Yeah.
And then Chloe came up to me and said, oh, you got a piano, haven't you? I said, yeah, you play, yeah. So and Chloe is the program director at the time. Still kind of, half is, I don't know what the quarter is, third is. Anyway, she's this legend, Chloe Goodyear, and she said, what should we do with this piano? We keep moving it, it's just an upright piano, moving it around. And I went, oh, well, you know, maybe you should put it in a stage on a bar or something, you know, make it a piano bar or, you know, because it's such a cool old thing and you can get piano players to play it or hire a piano player or whatever. And then you'd sort of have a, you know, kind of a saloon bar or something.
Yeah.
And then she went, oh, fuck yeah, okay, do you want to organize that? And I was like, fuck yeah, that's a lot to do at bar. So this is how you do it. I got like 6 or 7 really good people who weren't, did anything to do with bars. There was an architect, there was my brother Lockie, who's a journo. There's Rita, she's a nurse. There's Simon, he was transport. And there was, anyway, that was about, fuck, I forgot the other bit. Anyway, we used to have these brainstorms every month or so leading up to the festival. And then we ended up going in for the pineapple kind of idea. And because pineapples seemed pretty hip with the groove and the sign of wealth, and it just sounded funny, pineapple lounge. I used to have a bar called the Pandanus Lounge years ago in the valley during my some moment. And
during my I own a bar stage.
No, well, the thing is, you don't own a bar. It's actually you own a bar. You can pretend you kind of, you can't really say you own it.
No, but
for six.
Hey, mate.
6 months a year.
I owned a Spanish tapas bar a while ago as well, just because I like tapas.
Oh, yeah, cool.
You know, but yeah, you're right. You don't really own it. You just kind of create something and then move on.
Yeah, yeah. And you just have a bit of fun during the year. Yeah. I never know what to say. People go, oh, you're the owner, or you're the something or other of this bar. And you go, you're the manager? No, not the manager. There's people managing it.
I guess so.
The founder is such a wank term. And then you got...
You are a creative director. That's what I would call you. Not in the...
You can't say that at Woodford.
No, but I wouldn't... No. In your own lunchbox and in what you do, you are a creative director, right? In your own vibe. So, Juzzy, we've got 2 minutes left, just to let you know, before I... before I shoot up into the stars. And I wanted to know, like, you've got it's a really hard question, so I'm going to try and break it down a little bit, because you've done a couple of decades of documenting iconic musicians, let's just say that. Who sticks out in your mind? It can be someone from this year, because your memory goes that far back. Like, who is someone that really, it could be an unknown, that really just, you know, they had the whole enchilada, they were nice people, they play great, you know, they look great, and they just, yeah, good people. Who's some of those people you interviewed?
Well, I'll tell you who was surprisingly hilarious and just super entertaining, who's probably going to go up pretty soon on the Blues Fest thing. Tex Perkins, Cruel C.
I'm so glad you said that.
And his, the other guy who invented the Cruel C was in, what was his name? Johnny...
But you know, I'm actually really glad you said that, because I would say, other than Uramal, who I saw lots of times over the festival, and Here Come the Mummies, my other favourite performance was Tex, Cruel C, instrumental band just going nuts for about 5 minutes as an intro.
Yeah.
He just came out like full Michael Hutchins.
Yeah.
Vibes. Yeah. And I had these,
he's a sexy man.
I had these three young girls next to me who had just stumbled upon the set, and they went, oh yeah, we'll do whatever you're saying, oh yeah, yeah, tell us, do it, whatever. And they said, who is this? And I went, oh man, you're witnessing the 90s, early 90s here, like you're very lucky right now.
Totally. And so I'll tell you just quickly who else I really loved was PJ Morton.
Yeah, right, okay.
And so he was, someone's at the door. He came in, I didn't really know him, and we were using one of his songs for day four.
Yeah, I saw it.
Do you mind if you're using the song? He goes, yeah. And I said, you won some Grammys? He goes, 20 nominations? I've won 5. But as opposed to some other people, who's Americans often say that sort of stuff, and they sound, they're like, you know, don't question my amazingness, you know.
Yeah.
And they just, they're really
actually,
quite
so true.
Embarrassingly, brash about it.
Yeah.
And the other guys were the very cool guys were the Portugal the
Portugal.
Man.
Portugal, I said at the same time. I knew you were going to say
my God.
That. Yeah. Wow. I just saw
they're all cool, fucking cool guys.
So just to finish up, I just watched your recap of. Jack Johnson. Better when we're together. And you just like collated so many fucking epic musicians to sing a little portion of that song. So my question is, did you just give them the lyric and say, this is what you chaps have to do, and then we're going to tie it all together?
It's pretty, yeah, just like skating on, it's not skating on thin ice, but running on the seat of our pants, yeah. One of those expressions. And just people would come in and we go, oh, excuse me, at the end of the interview, we're doing this thing with Jack Johnson. They're going, what, Jack Johnson? He's like, yeah, Jack. So you know the song Better Together. Yeah, Johnny, can you cue the song? Play it.
Yeah.
He's playing it there. And can you just do a line? I'm just like, what, sing it now?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, look, I've got a butcher's paper here. Here's your line. Let's go. And,
do you know what?
And then you're pointing it underneath going, the lunchbox. And they're going.
You guys nailed it. I reckon I'm going to go out there and say it's probably one of the best I've seen. I really love that song.
It involved everyone, which I think they put it on Jack Johnson's page.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's got on his Insta. Compare Bluesfest Insta to Jack Johnson's Insta. And Jack Johnson put it on a few days after. Bluesfest Insta is at about 1,500 likes. Jack Johnson, 25,000 likes.
Oh, man. It was really good, Juzzy. And I know that's like seat of the pants in the sense of timing. Like, okay, this is what we're doing, and we're doing it now. Like, it's all that adrenaline that runs through you when you're in, you know, in that festival mode, which is why it takes you a couple of weeks to come down from it. I always used to describe my festival days when I was working intensely in them as having bipolar on the come down on the Monday. So I used to take myself to Gold Class Cinema and sit there and drink champagne just so I was immersed in another story. Because I just couldn't...
Oh, that's a great idea. Like meditation almost.
Couldn't come down from it. So I don't even know how you do. But Juzzy, I wanted to document your story today, and we've only just touched on it. But I also wanted to say that, you know, I know how hard you and your team work. You produce incredible stuff, super quick turnaround. And it's always really, you know, the visuals are great, the music's great, it's curated well.
Mm.
So, thank you. And next year I'm definitely finding you, and I want to do some interviews next year. So.
Oh, well, we're just going to cement that in. And
or else, because... you know what, we could do it somewhere else. Why don't we just take on the world together, hey? You'll find me in Spain. I leave tomorrow
morning. I'll bring my 15 crew and go, well, we're just following Kylie.
We're just following the travelling senorita. And tomorrow I leave to Spain for 3 months. So you're my last Aussie interview for a while, which my audience will be...
You little fucking beauty, mate.
My audience will be stoked that I've actually nailed you as well post-Blues Fest. Thanks so much for calling in from Melbourne town today, and keep on doing what you're doing, buddy.
Yeah, you too.
Ciao,
thanks,
buddy.
Thanks, Coz. Lovely to chat.
Adios.
See you, mate.
Hey, Juzzy, I'm still here.